ready to get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the Niche Website Builder podcast and YouTube channel. This week, I've got an awesome guest. His name is Chris from Niche Safari. He's a full-time blogger. He's been doing this for the past couple of years, having left his corporate job. He worked at the university, so he's teaching at a university. And Chris left that job because lifestyle was important to him. He now runs his business around his lifestyle, so it's very much a lifestyle business for him. But he's also made really good money, so it's not like a lifestyle business where you just make enough to live. Chris is also making really good money from this. In today's episode, we talk about his approach to building both Amazon websites and informational websites, which I think is interesting because most people tend to see success with one and then continue, but Chris has done both, so we get his perspective on that. And then towards the end of the interview, we also run through Chris's 7 top tips on how to win featured snippets, which are really awesome. Like, I love everything about them. So I thought it was really cool that we got to chat through those. And it's something actionable that you can take away from today's episode, implement for yourself, and it's nice quick wins. So I hope you get a lot from this. Let us know in the comments. Let's get into this.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
Hey, Chris, how's things?
Great, Adam. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome to the show. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to chat.
So you're over in Canada, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm in Vancouver.
Do you want me to say like A after everything? You mean kind of A? It's like traditional there.
You know, to be honest, my life is online. So I feel like I spend more time talking to Americans and Brits and things than going out and spending time with Canadians, especially during the pandemic, like life indoors. Literally yesterday, they finally reopened restaurants after 3 months of having them shut down.
Crazy, isn't it? We've been locked. So they've just opened them in the UK too, but we've been locked down since before Christmas.
Yeah.
So no restaurants and it's just, I don't know. Thank God we're coming out of it, right?
Exactly.
But your accent's obviously Australian or New Zealand?
Australian, yeah. So I grew up in Australia, finished my degree back home, and then I did the almost rite of passage for young Australians. I did the back and forth to Canada, snowboarding, doing ski seasons back and forth. And then I met a girl in a ski season and that was the end of me.
that old story, love story. Yeah. But so then she came back to the UK with you for some time, right? What were you doing in the UK?
So I got offered a job in Newcastle teaching at a university up there. So okay. I went up to the UK for 2 years trying to pursue a career as a university lecturer, essentially. And then we got to 2 years in the UK and my girlfriend said, it's time to move back to Vancouver. So we shipped up and came home, and it's probably a good decision in the end, because when I got here, I just was really not interested in getting another teaching job. So I kind of went all in on building websites. I gave myself about 2 years, and by the 2 year point, I was teaching part time, but by the 2 year point, I was ready to just go full time building websites. So essentially, that's what I did.
What were you teaching, by the way? What were you teaching in the university?
So I was originally like a primary school teacher or elementary school teacher, and yeah. I did that for a very short period of time. And then I went and I did PhD in education, and then I started teaching sort of sociology of education to university students.
Okay, nice. So yeah, that sounds like a great move then, going back there. I almost forced your hand, right, to jump in on to do the online stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I was reluctant to leave because I was kind of giving up this concept of having a career and
a good,
you know, I was working towards promotions and all of that stuff that I just can't imagine ever going back to. It sounds terrible.
No, well, it's funny because literally as we started this, I asked, did you have any hard limits on the time we had today? And you were like, nope, I have nothing else to do today.
Exactly. Yeah. For me, building websites is all about lifestyle. I'm more interested in being relaxed and having a good lifestyle than, you know, making $1 million. I mean, I wouldn't mind making $1 million, and one day hopefully I'll get there, but it's definitely more important that I have this comfortable lifestyle where, you know, no one wakes me up of a morning, except if I've got a podcast to do. And then, just knock off when I want.
Awesome. Well, I want to come back in a second to how you felt like you could just jump in to doing like this as a job. Like it obviously started way, you'd had some experience before this, but I always ask this to all of our guests is, how do you remember how and when you made your first dollar online?
Yeah. So my story for this would be pretty simple. When I started off, I was following people like John Dykstra, Doug Cunnington, Spencer Hawes, sort of teaching how to make websites. And I had to make that decision between whether I wanted to make an affiliate site or a display ad site. And I decided for my first site, I'll do a display ad site because I wanted the lowest possible competition so I can just see if I could rank. So essentially, I made a display ad site. As soon as I hit 10,000 page views, signed up to Azoic. And I think at the end of the first month of Azoic, I made about $80. So that was sort of the first amount of money I made.
Nice.
And we were actually backpacking at the time. We were backpacking South America, and I was just like, we stopped off at like a cafe or maybe it was a hotel we were at. And I just thought, you know, I'll just monetize it with Azoic. And then turned around like a month later and got my first $80 check. And I was like, this is cool. I could live this life of just backpacking around and making $80 a month. Hopefully that'll become $8,000 a month one day, and I can just backpack around and do whatever I want.
What was the site on? Was it about your traveling around at the time, or was it on something completely different?
It was on something completely different. I won't share the niche, but yeah, it was it wasn't about travel.
Right. Okay. Nice. So you'd already had some experience then before you moved to Canada and decided you were going to do this full time. Like, where were you at with your sites when you moved to Canada? Did you have some already set up or some generating revenue, or you forgot about them when you started again?
The first website I ever made was when I moved to Canada.
Oh, so what was the site when you were traveling around?
No, that was after. So when we moved to Canada, we didn't first settle in Vancouver. We were staying at a ski town for like a year, and then we went down to backpack Central America for 6 months, and I was building websites the whole time.
Right.
But I kind of consider that all sort of the move away from the corporate career sort of thing. And now, yeah.
So that's really cool. But how did you know about this whole world then? Were you just following people, and then when you moved to Canada, you thought, I'm just going to jump in, I'm going to start, I'm going to make a site?
I originally thought that I would make a website on Udemy, not a website, a course on Udemy. So I was like, yeah, maybe I could make a course on how to do podcasting. Or I was trying to brainstorm courses to do. And then I would listen to podcasts where people would say, well, Udemy, you're never going to make a great living out of because you sell a course for like $10 a pop. It's no use. Yeah. And then I sort of stumbled into this idea. Well, if you make a website and then get people to your website, then you can sell a course for $200 or $300 instead of $10 each. So that got me down the idea of thinking, well, instead of making a course right now, I should try to get an audience and then sell them the course later on. Yeah. But since then, the concept of having a course has totally fallen off, and all I want to do is make money from display ads now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Well, you've been pretty successful at this. So when, how long ago has it been since you moved to Canada? Was it a couple of years now?
Yeah, it was late 2019, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, I pretty much set up a website within weeks of getting to Canada, because I was in Canada on a tourist visa at the time.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really work here. So I was just like, what am I going to do with my time? May as well make a website.
Nice. All right. Well, 2019 to 2021. So fast forward literally like 3 years, basically, two or three years. And I know that you used to do on your website and your YouTube channel, which is great, by the way. I think everyone should check it out. We'll put some links in the description below. But you kind of stopped reporting your income figures when you got to a certain amount, which I think is fair. I think you were very open and honest up to that point. So, but you got to about $3,000 a month in revenue, and this was kind of mid-2020. So really, like, you went from nothing to a fairly decent income in just over a year, which is incredible. I take my hat off to you. Well done.
Right. I hope I have got my timelines right. But yeah, something along those lines. I think it might have been 18 months. So maybe I got here in 2018. It's just, it's all blending now. But yeah, I think essentially I was teaching for a university for a little while in when I was living in Canada. And when I quit there, it was 18 months after I started my site. So it took me 18 months to reach full-time living from my sites.
Nice. That's still really quick. That's still incredibly quick. So, I mean, yeah, I want to talk about them because, like, back in July, I watched your last income report. You kind of got, you had these five sites, three you just set up and two were kind of like your main revenue drivers. And those two sites, I think it's really cool because one was an Amazon affiliate website and one was monetized for display ads. And like most people pick one or the other. Like it's very rare to see someone who's been successful with them both. And that's kind of what the meat of what I want to talk about is like the difference between them both, because it's a totally different setup. It's a different way of selecting the niche. It's a different way of keyword research. And I think you've got a unique perspective in that you've come at it from both angles, and hopefully you can shed some experience and light on how you did that. So back in July, these sites combined were making $3,500. And we call them W1 and W2 just for like ease of use. So W1 is the display ad website and W2 is the Amazon site. How are these sites doing now? Are they still around? Are you still working on them? Have you sold them?
Yeah, so both of them are still doing well. They're still growing. They've grown month on month. The display ad site, which is essentially making all its money from display ads, I think I'm making maybe like somewhere between $500 and $750 a month on Amazon for that site. Yeah. But it's mostly just display ads monetized through Azoic. And it's the little engine that could. It just pumps along. Makes me feel comfortable that site's always there giving me enough money to live off each month so I can go off and just play with my other sites and you know, have a go at different niches and see if I can make money from other sites. So that's my safety blanket website. And it just keeps on going, which is really, really nice. And then the affiliate site is still going along quite well as well. It kept growing for a few months after I stopped reporting on it. And then it's sort of like a lot of websites. It grows, and then it sort of hits a plateau and it just hovers at that plateau. Yeah. So it's been hovering at that plateau for maybe 5 months now.
Yeah.
And it's a nice plateau. It makes decent money. And yeah, I'm trying to sell that one at the moment. So I'm hoping for that one to be my first six-figure exit.
Nice.
Just, you know, hopefully someone will snatch it.
That'd be awesome. Yeah, huge congratulations on that. That's when that deal closes, like, it'll change your life forever. Just the feeling of that deal is just great.
Yeah, crossing my, yeah, really hoping that it happens.
well, yeah, good luck with that. Okay, so they're both still doing well. I want to dive a little bit into like the approach that you took with them, because they've obviously been successful. But the approach is probably different because one's informational and one's like affiliate-based. So on the informational side, can you take us through like your full end-to-end approach, starting with niche selection? Like how did you come up with a niche or how do you come up with a niche for an informational site? What are you looking for when you're selecting that?
So for my first informational site, it was essentially just a hobby. It was something that I didn't put that much thought into it because I was at a point where I was just like, I didn't know better. I didn't know better to have to do like all this in-depth keyword research. And actually going back and looking at the first 100 articles on that site, probably the first 30 of them never ranked at all. And then you can kind of go and you can look back at the articles and you can see as you scroll through my post list on WordPress that I got better and better and better at choosing keywords. Yeah. And then the next, like maybe the next 70 to get me to 100, they were probably still too competitive. But the fact that I'd written 2,500 word sort of ultimate guide sort of stuff for all of these ones, they were just ranking for a ton of long tail keywords that I maybe wasn't even intentionally targeting. So I did get quite lucky. Just the fact that I just went deep on all of the articles and I was just so enthusiastic about creating the best articles I could. Yeah. That I probably wouldn't do that now. Like for my current case study site on that is also a display ad monetized primarily, it was a much more structured niche selection where essentially I had found a few keywords that I was ranking really well for on another one of my sites. And I went, hey, this is actually a really good keyword that I could make an entire website out of. So I just kind of pivoted that to a new website. And yeah, it's doing really well. And thing I would probably put down to that one is niche selection. I was much more thoughtful about choosing the keywords that I knew that I could rank for, even if I wasn't going to build links.
Interesting. So you kind of use the one site to springboard into another. So does that, so the first thing that comes to mind when you say that is how big is this niche that you've built the new site around? Is it quite narrow or is it still quite broad in the sense that it, you know, you just saw like a really broad keyword and thought, oh, that could be good.
It is quite narrow. So my thought process for the new one was to try to achieve topical relevance by going more narrow. And it turns out that even though it is quite narrow in a sense, there's still a lot of keywords within that narrow scope. Yeah. So I'll probably get to maybe 400 or 500 keywords before I sort of go, oh, maybe I'm going to have to broaden this out a little bit and make it and write about things that aren't specifically relevant to the domain name. But yeah, it was the intention for my newer one was to go more narrow.
Okay. I guess, is it easier to pick a niche when you're looking at an informational site versus like a product-based Amazon site?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like that's the whole reason that I'm pivoting more and more and more towards informational sites is it's easy to pick a niche because there's a lot more that you can look for. Like when I'm looking for a niche in selling products, I need to find a product that has got low competition on the SERPs for its sort of best X for Ys, or product versus product. And that's quite a saturated, the SERPs are pretty saturated for a lot of products, especially if the products are sold on Amazon. And then I want to say, well, can I start selling the product on Amazon, but then pivot to a relationship with the affiliate manager in that company and try to get those affiliates up to 10 or 15%. So there's the rules essentially around choosing a niche in affiliate, I feel are a lot tougher.
Yeah. Oh, 100% agree. Yeah. We'll talk about this a little bit later on, I think, because I think that's a whole subject on its own. But yeah, I 100% agree with you. It's so much more difficult to just do a pure product Amazon site these days. Mm-hmm. But when you're picking your niche for your informational site, are you taking anything into consideration like you know, what the potential RPMs could be, or are you using any metrics to kind of give you an idea of like, I can get traffic, but is this traffic actually going to be worth anything on a display revenue sense?
Honestly, mate, this is my weakness. Every time I create a display ad site, like this one that I'm currently working on, my case study on my YouTube channel, I'm about to hit 12 months. I'm just toward the end of 11 months. I'm pretty sure I'll get to 100,000 page views within 12 months. And I did that for my first display ad site as well. So I don't have any trouble getting traffic, but I'm also getting EPMVs with the Zoic down around that $8, $8.50 mark. So it's just, for me, on both of those sites, it's just a numbers game. Just put out as much content as you can, get 500,000 page views a month and bank through that. So I'm not sure it was entirely intentional, but I guess the intention behind it is I'm going for the lowest competition keywords I can possibly find. And I know that even a really low competition keyword where, you know, 30% of my traffic is coming from the Philippines is still going to be getting me an EPMV of around about $8.50. So, you know, if I get 100,000 page views really easy, is it really that different to getting 100,000 page views really difficultly over a longer period of time? Like, it's probably is all going to come out in the wash. So my strategy is essentially just being like, just rank for anything.
No, it's a good strategy. In all honesty, it's something I've never really considered much until recently. And I was, my eyes were only open to it more so because we created a website for a customer that was in, it would typically be in like you call in your money, your life space and like the finance slash kind of like finance slash legal space, I guess. And we went at it from a question based perspective. So it's all the long tail question based stuff. And it started getting traffic really quick. And the EPMs he's getting are like $50 to $70. And I was like, wow, like at this kind of level, you really don't need much traffic to make decent money. And then I did, something just clicked. I thought, well, yeah, like what's best? Is it going for like hundreds of thousands of page views or is it going for like 50,000, but with a crazy high, rate? I don't know what the answer is, but I just thought that was really cool to see. And it just triggered something to think about.
Yeah, Adam, I honestly do think that would be amazing. I wish that I could make a site that was just getting $50 EPMVs and I don't care if it's only getting 20,000 page views. That would be amazing. And one day, hopefully I'll do it. But I'm just so adverse to competition and risk that I just, it's the path of least resistance. And I guess it goes back to this idea of me trying to build a lifestyle more than build this sort of publishing empire. The lifestyle for me is not that I want to spend all day, every day sending out outreach emails to get backlinks in order to finally rank an article. I would rather just pump out like 5 blog posts a day or something and just get tons of traffic. It's just a different model.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's definitely. And I actually like your model. It's the John Dykstra model, right? It's
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So keyword research obviously sounds like it plays a big part in your, in this method, because it sounds like you didn't quite do it right to start with and those blog posts didn't quite go anywhere. And it's funny that you saw them improve over time. Yeah. Can you share a little, some detail around how you approach your keyword research?
Yeah. So my approach to keyword research has changed over time as well. So if you went to some of my earlier YouTube videos, you would see that I was very focused on looking at the SERPs and seeing if there were low DA competitors on the SERPs. And I think I would still do that if I was building out Amazon affiliate sites as aggressively as I was 18 months ago. But now it's mostly around going to the SERPs and seeing, is anyone targeting the same keyword in the H1? So if you spend three or four hours just doing Google auto suggest, finding Google auto suggest keywords or finding keywords using Ahrefs or however you want to find keywords and then going to the SERPs and just eyeballing the SERPs, there's a good chance that you'll be able to find plenty of keywords that are not even in the H1s of any of the articles ranking on the first page of Google. So that's firstly a great sign to me. It's like if no one else is targeting directly this keyword and everyone's just putting it in their H2s halfway down their pages, I'm going to create a page that targets directly that keyword, does a really good job of it, and then it'll probably outrank them. Other things that I look at is obviously hoping that Reddit and Quora are owning the SERPs, or any other forums that are in the niche are owning the SERPs, then I'm going for it.
That's really interesting. And I've seen something similar. I've seen more and more this recently because people sometimes talk about their approach to keyword research being almost the opposite of that, in that they'll Google something like a keyword and like they'll see that the websites on page one aren't specifically optimized for that keyword. Therefore, Google like thinks the intent is different and then they won't create that. But more and more I've seen, and we'll talk about this later on because I think this is probably where this comes into play even more, is what I'm seeing now is when you Google that keyword, like the featured snippet will be optimized for that and then the rest of the articles won't be. And I think, because you just put out some awesome information on winning featured snippets, which I want to go into later, but I think that probably plays hand in hand with each other.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought. I'm going to make sure that I keep an eye on that now. Yeah. It hadn't really crossed my mind.
Have you used anything like, one of my next questions is any tools you use, but I know Ben Adler's Keyword Chef tool is really good for also pushing out keywords that have lots of forums and Reddit and things like that on page one. Have you tried that?
No, I haven't tried Ben's tool. I generally am pretty big on Ahrefs. I'll buy a month of Ahrefs and then cancel my month and try to get all my keyword research done within that month. And it's literally less than a month later where I'm like, no, I'm sorry, I need Ahrefs back again. So I am pretty addicted to Ahrefs. But to be honest, like the best tool is just Google.
Yeah.
Searching keywords on Google and seeing what it's suggesting and eyeballing the SERPs, because you know, even with Ahrefs can spit out a ton of awesome keywords for me, but even after that, I'm still going back to Google and looking at the SERPs because I need to know what the SERPs genuinely look like before I make any decision. So, you know, I think that anyone could probably build a website just straight up from looking at Google and not using any tools at all, because it's a really good tool.
Yeah, just a bit of common sense. Looking at Google and some common sense, right? And a spreadsheet.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty much. Okay. How are you structuring these sites? Because there's so much information about how people should structure sites and things like, using silos. Are you using hard silos, virtual silos? Like, are you putting much thought into that, or is it just doesn't really make too much of a difference for your process?
Yeah, I am putting a lot of thought into it. I used to sort of do, I guess, what you'd call virtual silos, where I didn't have the sort of subcategories in the URL. Ever since going to hard silos where I've got the subcategories in the URL and I'm planning out the categories more, I'm never going to go back because it feels so much cleaner for me to do it that way. So I am doing hard silos these days and I'm trying to plan them out before I build out a website. Having said that, I don't think that you have to. I mean, I've got plenty of successful websites that don't do that. And then for my link building, for my internal linking, I essentially just use Link Whisper, and Link Whisper's got cool tools in it now. Like, you can only linking within a certain category, for example. I'd usually check that box on Link Whisper, and then Link Whisper will find link opportunities only within the category. So that's kind of the main way that I'll interlink within the silos. If I were on Amazon affiliate sites, so if we would go back to all the Amazon affiliate sites I own, I'm a lot more intentional about here's the best X for Y that I want to rank for. So 7 best lamps, and then I will write a review of each of the lamps, and then at the end of each review I would have a link off to every individual lamp, and I would have a review of every individual lamp as well, so that they are sort of surrounding the central best X for Y. And then at the bottom of the best X for Y articles, my best X for Y articles are usually up around 3,000 or 4,000 words. At the bottom of that, I'll have sort of the buyer's guide. And in the buyer's guide, I'll be linking off to things like how to change a light bulb, how to turn on a lamp, all of that stuff. So I'm very intentional around building informational content around the individual product reviews and the individual product reviews around the best X for Y in order to create as much topical relevance as possible.
Would they also link back to the Best X to Y page as well, or are you just linking from the Best X out?
I personally do link back. I know that there's so many different theories about silo structure. One of the reasons that I do link back is because it does my head in when I'm on Link Whisper and it's telling me that I've got orphaned pages because I'm only linking in one direction. And I'm just like, I can't do that. It hurts my head to see orphaned pages on my website. And yeah, so that's kind of the main reason, I guess. But I've also sort of followed some gurus in the space who also link back, back and forth. And I'm just like, well, if it's good enough for this guy is probably banking $5 million a month, then it's good enough for me.
Nice. Awesome. That's a good tip. Okay. And then, so on the display ad, I know it's, you mentioned that it's mainly Ezoic, and then you've got some Amazon affiliate stuff on there as well. But one thing which I want to talk about, because I don't really see, I know John Dykstra has mentioned this before, but I don't really see many other people talk about this, and that's using exit intent pop-up as well, right?
Yeah, I was. I've actually taken that down recently, partially because I got rid of Elementor and I was building it with Elementor.
Right.
But yeah, I was using it and it was getting results.
So, well, before we move on to the Elementor thing, what were you... Like, how are you using these exit intent pop-ups? Was it just... Like, what kind of offers were you running in there? What worked best for those?
Sure. Yeah, so they were SaaS products that had free trials. So I would say, I think all of this category on this website has people coming to this website who would have an interest in this SaaS product. It's got a free trial, so I can just do a pop-up and it's got like me standing there sort of smiling, trying to build some cred, and then a quote from me next to it saying, you know, Chris recommends this SaaS product and guess what? It's 100% free for the first month. So you may as well give it a go. And then click this link. They click the link and download the SaaS product, and a certain percentage of them will end up buying the pro version. And then I get the money from it. But it was important to me to choose one that had a free trial of a product, so that the people who it would just increase my click-through rate, because they weren't actually going to buy something straight away.
That makes sense. Did you test anything other than SaaS products, or was it just mainly SaaS products you tested there?
Well, I did try out my own ebook, and it was a complete failure. I think like I had literally millions of people coming through my website and seeing that pop up and zero sales.
Oh my God. Were you doing the whole Chris standing there thing as well?
Yeah. With like I found a website that could make what looked like an ebook. So you could create the book cover, and it's got the book sitting sort of slightly open so you can see the pages inside. And I put that like as if I was holding it, and nothing worked.
That's crazy. Okay, interesting. So you've stopped that now because you're moving away from Elementor. Does that mean you're moving your whole site away from Elementor, just the posts? What's that approach?
Yeah, I essentially, like, Ezoic was bugging me about getting rid of Elementor for a long time. So I finally just went, look, I'll get rid of Elementor. And I've realized that I only had about maybe 20 or 30 posts that were on Elementor plus my homepage. And the reason I was using it was really for the main homepage. So I essentially just went through all of those posts, reverted them back to Gutenberg. And then with Gutenberg blocks now, especially if you get the ultimate add-on, you can essentially recreate the look of Elementor really quickly with Gutenberg blocks. So I just recreated the look. It looks exactly the same as it did with Elementor. And now Elementor is not there. Although I do constantly stumble upon Elementor code that they've left lying around my website everywhere.
Okay. So you've got to delete that rubbish then.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a bit lazy. Like, I just delete it if I find it, you know?
Did you find that your website speeded up much after you got rid of Elementor?
Yeah. See, I was just doing too many things at once to know exactly what it was that sped it up. But, yeah, I mean, I've recently put Leap on as well, so that probably had an impact. So none of my sites are passing core web vitals. They're all in the sort of either green, you know how there's those three core web vitals categories. I'm usually like green for one and amber for two, or green for two and amber for one, or something like that. But then when I check against my competitors, all my competitors are red for all of them. So, you know, wow. What's the point of trying to win a race by 1,000 miles when you can win it by a meter?
Yeah, I think it's going to be, I mean, I'm no fortune teller or anything, but I think it's not going to be a massive impact from Google. I think it's going to be some kind of like tie indicator where if there's you and another website that are, you know, neck and neck, Google might use it to determine who they're going to push up one. So the fact that all your competitors are red, probably a good sign for you, but
yeah,
you don't have to be green to get the boost.
Exactly. That's what I'm hoping. And I'm also hoping that it's not as big a deal as everyone's making it out to be, but
yeah.
I mean, who knows? Sometimes Google just goes really hard at things and then rolls it back over the next few months. So maybe they'll just tank everyone. Who knows?
How are you finding Leap, by the way? I know it's quite new, and I see some people loved it. Some people had issues setting it up and it broke things. What's your experience been like?
Well, I essentially, like when you turn Leap on, so Leap is the new Sightseed Speed Accelerator for Zoic, and it's free.
Yeah.
When you turn it on, there's an option where it says, you can either set it up yourself or get a manager to set it up. And I just said, get a Zoic to set it up. And they set it all up for me. They emailed me back a couple of days later and they said, yep, this is all set up. And then I went to, they've got this technologies page that says what you should do. And there's things like get rid of certain fonts. So I just changed a couple of fonts, get rid of these plugins, got rid of the plugins, not a big deal. So I just followed their instructions and it was all pretty straightforward. And it was at least as good as Sightspeed Accelerator, maybe a little bit better. And now it's free. So happy days.
Better. Nice. Out of curiosity, I'm assuming you've been invited into the Zoic program, the premium program. Yeah. Do you pay for that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm obviously you make more than you, because I see people talk about this in the groups all the time as well, about, you know, why do Zoic charge you for premium and give it back to you on the back end? Like, it's obviously a good thing for you, I'm assuming, because of the size of the sites that you have in there.
Yeah, so obviously I would prefer if they just did a revenue share model. But, you know, for whatever reason, they think that they should be doing it this way. So it still makes sense for me to pay for it. And I just put it on my credit card, get the air miles, write it off on tax. It's not a big deal. My accountant deals with it.
Cool. So one thing I haven't asked you directly, but you kind of answered it, is about content creation. It sounds like you write in a lot of this content yourself. Is that right?
Yeah. So I have five writers, I think. Two of them are essentially full-time. They're writing an article a day for me, essentially, if not more.
Yeah.
And then the other ones are just a couple of guys who I think they're university students, and they'll just send me some content when they feel like sending me content, essentially. And I'm fine with that. And yeah. That's all for one website that I don't report on in any of my YouTube stuff. But it's just this website that I'm entirely outsourcing. I went in Ahrefs, found 600 keywords, and just sent the 600 keywords to all my writers and said, go for it. And once those 600 articles are done, I'll get Ahrefs, get another 600 keywords and send them out to them. So I'm not doing any content for that site, and I'm adding maybe, well, at least 60 articles a month to it. And nice. I'm just the manager for that site. And then for my sites that, so essentially my four core sites, or my three core sites, because one of them's essentially failed, I'm writing all the content for them. So I'll essentially, my daily routine is wake up and try to finish an article by midday. If I press publish on an article, it's a great day. If I press publish on another article at the end of the day, it's an even better day. But try to get out an article a day at least.
Nice. I think that's a lot of people struggle with that. Like, a lot of people hate writing. Like, for my first website, I did all of the writing myself, and I'm not a writer. Like, I hate writing, especially about stuff I don't know. Like, it might be different if you know about the niche, but I literally had no idea about the topic I was writing about either. And I hated that. It was so hard to stay motivated. It was so hard to, you know, crank another one out and learn more about these products that I frankly didn't really care about. And
I'm assuming that you outsource all of your content at the moment then.
Well, I own a content agency now, so it's
true.
So yeah, I don't do any writing anymore. But even after that, so after that I sold the first website, I promised myself that I would not do any writing again. Just because it was, of the whole experience, it was the bit that I hated the most. And then I flitted around between, you know, trying to find reliable reliable freelancers and different agencies. And I'm sure our audience are kind of sick of hearing the story, but that's how we started our agency, because I couldn't find anyone that I trusted enough or liked enough to do it. So built our own team. But yeah, how do you stay focused on that, writing every day, day in, day out?
Well, one of the things is you just said that you're writing about products that you don't particularly care for. That's one of the reasons I don't do Amazon affiliate as much. Not only because it's more competitive, because I just don't care for writing about products. It's not interesting to me. So yeah, I mean, it is boring writing every day, but I feel as if maybe it's that I'm conscious of the fact that I have a really privileged lifestyle brand, like, or a lifestyle business, I should say. I'm waking up and I'm just writing a blog post and pressing publish on it. And I don't have a boss. I don't have meetings. I don't have colleagues that annoy me. I don't have students sending me 1,000 emails. Like, that is all I care for. That's all I want in life, to be left alone. And if I'm being left alone writing blog posts about topics that I get to choose, then I'm really don't care if it's a little bit boring.
Yeah, when you put it like that, I mean, it's better than working a job.
Yeah, exactly. And mate, like, I went to the park the other day with a bunch of friends, and it was Friday afternoon, and they were just sitting there moaning for hours about how much they hated their jobs and how much they hated their bosses. And I was just like, I didn't want to say anything, but I just thought, wow, I am so glad that I make websites for a living, because I don't have to. I remember I was this person 2 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just be grateful that all I have to do is write blog posts.
Yeah, when you put it like that, I guess that's a pretty easy way to stay motivated, is have friends who hate their job.
Yeah, exactly.
Talk to them once a week. Cool. Okay. Just go back to the difference then between like an affiliate site and an informational site. So back in July, and I'm not sure how many posts are on there now, but back in July, the display ad website had like almost 250 posts, and an Amazon site that had about 85 posts. I guess, does that mean your ROI was better on the Amazon site because there's less posts? Or you mentioned that your best of guides are like 3,000-4,000 words. Like, was it roughly same word count overall? Like, what do you think is best ROI there?
I would say that the ROI is significantly better with Amazon affiliate. If I'm just building out a website with Amazon affiliate, it's probably less work. I probably don't enjoy the work nearly as much, but to hit $3,000 a month, personally, I feel as if the work is probably not as much work. I probably will, you know, writing 100 articles that are Amazon affiliate review articles, I could probably only crank one of them out a day, whereas I could crank a few blog posts out a day for my informational site. So that does sort of balance it out a little bit. But on balance, just as a personal sort of subjective thing, it does seem like it's easier and faster to get an Amazon affiliate site up to a quit your job income. But it's just not what I enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. You're all about the lifestyle, I've quickly found out.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Have you always built from scratch? Have you ever bought the site, or have you ever worked on expired domains?
I've never bought a site, never worked on an expired domain. I am intrigued by the idea of buying expired domains, especially because of all these Google indexing issues of the last 12 months or so. Every single one of my new sites, I'm constantly having to go back and check if it's reading the sitemaps, check if it's just kicking things out of the index randomly, re-indexing things. Like, there's so many problems around the Google index at the moment that the idea of buying an expired domain is increasingly attractive to me, with the idea that it's already got a crawl budget, for example. So that does appeal to me, but I just don't know enough about it. And I'd have to listen to a whole bunch of podcasts about it and read a bunch of articles about it before I sort of threw myself into it. And then the other part of it is I really like sitting around on Namecheap coming up with domain names for hours on end. So
nice. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, expired domains are a bit of a minefield. Like, we did a whole episode on eight things of what you should look for when buying an expired domain. And like, it was like an hour long just talking about like top level what you should look for, because there's so many small things that can trip you up. I remember one of our customers sent us and they're expensive. Like one of our customers sent us a domain name to vet for him. And it was $4,000 or $5,000. And I mean, we put it through our process and it almost passed. Like, everything looked great. Like everything looked great. Apart from in one of the way back instances where you can check like what the site used to be about. I couldn't find any outbound links on there, but the title tag on the page had something to do with Viagra in there. And that was it though. I couldn't find any outbound links to any other website. It was just that title. And I was like, dude, I can't find anything wrong apart from that, but like, you don't want to spend $4,000 or $5,000 just in case.
Yeah.
And it was so easy to miss. Like, so easy to miss.
Yeah, exactly. See, that's one of the reasons why I'm a bit nervous to do it.
Wait, one of your sites, the W2 you mentioned.
Yeah.
Back in July when you launched it, well, when you were talking about it then, it had been live for 5 months, but you'd registered the domain like, the domain had been registered for 11 months. Was the site live for those couple of months before you actually started pushing content, or was it just you registered it and you hadn't set anything up?
Yeah. So that was like this interesting thing that I sort of stumbled upon was I created this website. It was actually when I was backpacking, I was listening to a Doug Cunnington podcast, and he was at the time going on and on about how good Amazon affiliate is, and I didn't own an Amazon affiliate site at the time, so I was like, I just came up with a niche idea that I think would be pretty good, but I don't really have time to work on it right now. So I wrote, I think it was somewhere between 5 and 10 articles, put them on, made sure they were indexed, and then ignored it until I got back to Canada after I was backpacking in South America. And when I got back to Canada, I started adding content at around about the 6 month mark, and it was indexed for 6 months already. And then I just started adding this content, and this content started ranking like within, you know, 4 or 5 weeks. And I was kind of like, did I just manage to avoid the sandbox by indexing a website with a couple of articles on it and just wait 6 months?
Yeah.
So it was an interesting little case study.
That happened, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Mark, my co-founder, had a similar experience where he put some, I don't know how many posts, it was less than 10 posts on a site. And then he literally forgot about it until he was looking through his analytics one day and was like, oh, check this out. So I was doing like 10,000 visits a month.
Oh,
like,
really?
What the hell? Like, what's going on here?
Wow.
And he started adding content now, and it's taken off really well. Like, but he did the same thing, like, put a couple of articles and thought I'd come back to this, but he forgot about it for a longer time.
Yeah,
I wonder if that's an actual like strategy you could do rather than buying expired domains to try and skip the sandbox. Like, could you just push out 5 or 10 of these sites with 10 articles on each and just leave them sit for 6 months?
Yeah.
Come back, see which one's doing okay, and go from there.
Yeah, to be honest, I actually have a few of them. I'm probably never going to go back to them all. But if I get a niche idea, I just go, yeah, maybe I'll just register a domain and write a couple of articles and put them up. And they're just like these sleeper sites that one day, if I've got nothing going on, I'll go, oh, going to work on that site for a couple of months.
Yeah. Nice. Maybe you could sell them. Like, you could sell that.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. I mean, they're not making any money.
No, true.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of people like that you used to follow back in the day when you started. And you've always, like, say, you've been really successful with this. So have you followed any kind of course or framework or methodology for this? Or did you just kind of figure it out yourself as you went through this all?
Yeah, I guess my mentality toward all of this sort of learning how to do all of this is that it's all available for you out there. You've just got to piece it all together. So, you know, sort of thinking about the value of a course, I see it as, one, someone's put all of this information together in a linear fashion for you and taking you step by step through it. Cause it's not, none of this is a secret.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many podcasts talking about all the strategies, So what is the value of a course? Someone putting it together for you for a linear fashion, or someone who's like, I need to put down $300 in order to motivate myself to make sure that I push through it. And I didn't think that I needed either of those things. I was motivated enough and I could piece together the knowledge. So I never really bothered with the course. But in terms of like, if there was a certain guru or whatever that I choose to be my guru, at different times, there were different people. So there was a while where I was just like really hot on the Matt Diggity method. And I was just like doing everything Matt Diggity did. And this is back when I was creating affiliate sites. And he's, you know, obviously big on link building. So I was following him with the link building and making sure you do the social fortress and things. And then as I sort of evolved, I've moved more towards sort of following more of a John Dykstra for a while. So I just kind of go here, there, and everywhere and just pick things up from different people depending on the mood I'm in.
Yeah. I think that's a great approach, to be honest. Just be fluid, be flexible, see what's working best for other people. Like, I'm a massive fan of not reinventing the wheel twice. Like,
right, yeah.
For everything. Like, if I can see something successful for somebody else, then how do I do it the same or better? And that's a methodology we interpret for our keyword research as well. If we find sites that are doing well that are weaker than us, like, how do we imitate them? Do a better job. So
yeah,
from top to the bottom, I'm a big fan of that. Okay, we're coming close to the end here, but there's one thing which I wanna cover off because it ties into what we spoke about earlier about featured snippets. And you've come up with this framework, which I think is awesome, like about winning featured snippets. And I think it would give some awesome value to our audience. I've got we linked to the video, but you basically come up with seven tips on how to win a featured snippet. And we're big on featured snippets. Most of the keyword research we do is based around keywords that are eligible for featured snippets. So I think this is great. Do you just kind of want to, if I give you like the title of these seven things, just give us your input on them or why you think they're important for the sneak snippet. So first one is copy the current snippet.
Yeah, that's so straightforward. But
yeah.
I mean, I'm probably getting ahead of myself because you might mention this in another step, but you look at the current snippet and there's all this text in bold and it's seemingly so obvious that Google's just like, oh, this person's use all these words that are LSI phrases or whatever of this topic and they've used it five times. So I'm going to go in and I'm going to use those similar words six or seven times. And all of a sudden Google's like, oh, well, this person's better. I mean, the featured snippet is quite simple compared to a lot of the other things within the Google algorithm. They show you what they're doing.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's great. Okay. The next one is write your definitions, which are 40 to 60 words long. It's kind of self-explanatory, but yeah.
Yeah, quite simple. And I think I have some friends who are saying that Income School has a similar approach to this. And I think something that Income School did was they interviewed all the people in their course and asked people in their course like how long their text is for their featured snippet. And all the people in their course were saying, yeah, we've got it within this like very defined length, 40 to 60 words or whatever it is. Yeah. And it seems to be that that's the sweet spot that Google's like, yep, that sounds great.
Nice. So there's three different types of snippets. So you've got the list, the paragraph, and what was the third one? Table, yeah. So for the list ones, create the list directly under optimized H2 tags.
Yeah, super easy, super straightforward. I find that it's one of the things that works best is just optimized H2 bullet points.
Yeah. Answer the questions immediately at the top of the article, which I thought was really cool because this is such a quick win. Like the example you gave where you moved basically the paragraph of text from three quarters of the way down to the top of the article, like such a quick win.
Yeah, it is like... This is totally subjective and I may be completely wrong, but it seems to me as if your snippet is further up the page than someone else's bit that would be the featured snippet, you get a slight advantage in whatever their snippet algorithm is. So the further it is to the top of the page, I feel as if the more likely it is Google's going to pick it up. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I don't have data.
Tables can win snippets too.
Oh yeah. I'll tell you, there was an update in October last year. It was like 5 days before Prime Day. And I got slammed for one of my affiliate sites just before Prime Day, which was like devastating for me. But when I went through it, one thing that I realized was Google just took away all of my table snippets off me in that update. But
wow.
Yeah, up until that point, I was just absolutely killing it making tables, and just Google was putting all my tables into the snippet. So I don't know, like, I do feel as if the snippet's kind of losing, is less and less common now. Maybe, you know, people were saying that it may have to do with that. In the United States, there was all this stuff about Google stealing data and putting the data in the snippet. Right, I'm not sure. I'm not entirely following it, but
yeah,
the snippet has kind of, for me at least, I've been winning less and less of the snippet, or the snippet's been just appearing less and less. But there was a while there last year when tables were just absolutely killing it.
What were they replaced with? When you lost the snippet tables, were they just replaced with other snippets, or did the snippet just disappear altogether?
So mostly the snippet just disappeared. For a few of them, Google decided to stick its own products there, like a carousel of its own products.
Well, yeah, that's typical Google, isn't it?
Yeah.
Structure your H tags correctly.
Yeah. So you'll often see there's actually a plugin for it. I'm not sure what the Chrome extension is, but you can use this Chrome extension to see H tags. And you can often see that someone jumps from an H1 to an H4 to an H3 to an H4 to an H2 or something. And it jumps too much. And if you just simply go H2, H3, 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 H2, H3, 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 Google can pick that up a little bit better in my experience. I'll often do a list, all my H, like a listicle essentially, and my H2 is an optimized like 7 best deciduous trees. And then underneath it, it's like 1 this tree, 2 that tree in the H2s. And then Google will get in the H3s. And then Google will get all of those H3s and turn them into a list for the snippet.
That makes sense. I agree. I use a plugin, Chrome extension for that called the SEO Meta in One Click. It gives a nice visual like overview. I think there's a couple of different ones. But the other thing I think that's good for is having them structured that way is I think more and more importantly are table of contents for jump links. And having your H tag structured in a nice way like that means your table of contents also looks better at the top too.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And the last tip you've got is use professional niche language, which I don't think many people actually consider as a thing, but you definitely think it is.
Just in terms of like, I think the example that I used in that video was I noticed that Google was loving phrases like kilometers or miles or that sort of language. Like if it's like how far from Vancouver to Seattle. And if you say, use those words like miles, kilometers, that sort of thing, they're the things that are bolded by Google in the snippet. So it's like, hey, actually Google is like noticing that you're using this language and rewarding you for using this language. And I also like going back to the tables, a lot of my tables would rank quite well because I would have like, if I'm selling cars and I'm writing how many pistons the car has. One column would be pistons, and then one would be 6, then another one would be 8, and then another one would be 4, and so on.
Yeah.
And I was seeming to get rewarded for all these things. Now that I'm talking to you about this, it's sounding like I'm like making up hocus pocus. So these are all all just like my own subjective opinions and not based on data.
No, in all honesty, you can't really test this stuff because it's difficult to know like why you win a snippet. But I think this is great advice. Like honestly, it's awesome advice. One thing which I've noticed, which I want to add to the end as one of my tips is since the introduction of like passage indexing, one thing which I've noticed, and I don't know if you've seen this, is when you sometimes click on a featured snippet now, it takes you to the place in the article and it's highlighted in yellow, but what I've been noticing more and more of is the featured snippet is made up of more than one sentence, and it's not typically in the same place on the on the page. So like it may be a sentence from the top and then a sentence from the bottom, but they've merged together into the snippet. And if you find that, and then you recreate or rewrite like the two sentences, but together in a shorter paragraph, that's also a nice way of trying to win them too.
That's basically a really good idea.
Oh, I want this sentence and this sentence, but I'm having to take it from two places in this competitor piece. And if you say, well, here it is, Google, in one concise, you know, next to each other, they also seem to like that too.
That's great, Adam. I'm going to start doing that too.
Yeah, and it's really easy to find. Like, you just literally have to look for snippets, click on the competitor result and see if the sentences are together. And if they're not, just add it to yours as one block.
Yeah. Awesome.
The other thing that you mentioned, which I think which is really interesting, is to use the minus URL operator. I've not come across that before. Tell us about that. That's really cool.
I've obviously learned this from someone else, but I don't know who I learned it from, so I can't give them credit. So sorry to the person out there who I learned this off. But yeah, essentially, if Wirecutter, even though it's not even a thing anymore, but wirecutter.com is ranking number one, ranking for the snippet, and you want to know who's next in line for the snippet, just type in the keyword next to it, write minus wirecutter.com, and that removes Wirecutter from the results. And then whatever is next in line for the snippet will pop into the top, into the snippet. So you can essentially keep doing that. You can minus the first person who has a snippet, then minus the second person who has a snippet, then minus the third person who has a snippet until it gets to you. And you can go, okay, I'm fifth in line right now for the snippet. And then you do a little bit of optimization, and then you come back the next day and you're third in line for the snippet, or you're seventh in line for the snippet. So you can see whether or not your optimizations are moving you up the priority or not.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's really cool that you can see that.
Yeah.
And also, I guess it's cool because you can see, I'm assuming the more you do that, the more like commonalities you'll see between like first, second, or third position, and then compared to yours, like maybe they're all doing something specific that you're not doing, and you're like, oh yeah, like those three are doing this, I'm not doing that, like test that out.
Yeah.
So a quick way, if you've got a site currently and you want to like figure out where do you start optimizing for your featured snippets, if you've got an Ahrefs account, you can go to Ahrefs and the organic keywords list, and then there's the little tick box at the top, and you can just tick featured snippets. And then if you just select the positions 2 to 5, you can literally get all of the keywords that you're currently ranking for that are eligible for featured snippets, where you don't have one, but you're already on page one. So I think that's like, if you listen to this now and you think, yeah, I'm going to go away and do everything that Chris just said because I want to win featured snippets, like that's a good way to figure out what pages you may want to try and optimize.
Yeah, definitely. And to be honest, like, a lot of the time I'll spend an hour trying to win the featured snippet for a high value article, and yeah, I just can't win it. I try all of my tips and tricks and I just can't do it. So sometimes it takes a long time for you to finally crack it.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's not even worth it. Sometimes the time spent on trying to get one, like you could have probably did another 5 or 10 at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
You mess around and test and come back and yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. I know you've got your own kind of like newsletter and community of other people where you share this stuff with. Where can people find more from you, Chris? Like if they want to learn more about you or follow you, where's the best place for that?
Yeah, for the most part, I just have a YouTube channel, which I'm not even selling anything. I have the YouTube channel because it's kind of like, I don't really have colleagues to sit and chat with about these things. So the YouTube channel is for me to get to know people and chat with people about things and share my knowledge and get other people sharing their knowledge with me. So you can go to, if you just type in Niche Safari on YouTube, you'll be able to find my YouTube channel and follow me there. I do have a newsletter. It's sort of, I'll send an email whenever I think about it, really. It's the same with the YouTube channel. I was trying for a while to do one video a week. And then I kind of realized, it was like, what should my priorities be? Should my priority be writing a couple of blog posts, or should it be creating a YouTube video that isn't really making me any money anyway? Yeah. So you can follow me at Niche Safari. I always do my income reports. The income reports are usually coming out at the start of the month, and then usually one or two other videos throughout the month. But yeah, don't expect consistency from me because I'm just doing my own thing.
One thing I forgot to ask you was, where does the name Niche Safari come from? Like, what's that about?
Right. So when I started the YouTube video, YouTube channel,
yeah,
I was intending to each video look at another niche and say whether or not I would go into that niche. And I did that for like three videos. I think I did gloves and boxing and like baseball. And then I just gave up on that, but I kept the name.
Nice. Awesome. Okay. Is there anything you think that I haven't covered with you, Chris, that you think might be of interest?
No, I think we covered a lot of stuff. Yeah, it was all good.
Cool. Well, Chris, I really appreciate your time. I know our audience is going to love this one, this episode. So, yeah, thanks for your time and hope to chat to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Appreciate it.
Cheers, man. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you're listening to the podcast version of this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please rate and review, as this will allow us to grow our audience and create more shows like this one. If you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to the channel and click on the bell to be the first to know about any new episodes that we release. Until the next episode, goodbye.